Chapter 5. I know the press only too well. Almost all editors hide away in spider dens, men without thought of family or public interest, or the humble delights of jaunts out of doors, plotting how they can put over their lies and advance their own positions and fill their greedy pocketbooks by calumniating statesmen who have given their all for the common good and who are vulnerable because they stand out in the fierce light that beats around the throne. 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. The June morning shone. The last petals of the wild cherry blossoms lay dew-covered on the grass. Robins were about their brisk business on the lawn. Doremus, by nature a late liar and pilferer of naps after he had been called at 8, was stirred to spring up and stretch his arms out fully 5 or 6 times in Swedish exercises in front of his window, looking out across the Beulah River Valley to dark masses of pine on the mountain slopes 3 miles away. Doremus and Emma had had each their own bedroom these 15 years, not altogether to her pleasure. He asserted that he couldn't share a bedroom with any person living because he was a night mutterer, and liked to make a really good, uprearing, pillow-slapping job of turning over in bed without feeling that he was disturbing someone. It was Saturday, the day of the prang revelation, but on this crystal morning, after days of rain, he did not think of prang at all, but of the fact that Philip, his son, with wife, had popped up from Worcester for the weekend, and that the whole crew of them, along with Lorinda Pike and Buck Titus, were going to have a real old-fashioned family picnic. They had all demanded it, even the fashionable Sissy, a woman who, at 18, had much concern with tennis tees, golf, and mysterious, appallingly rapid motor trips with Malcolm Tasbro, just graduating from high school, or with the Episcopal parson's grandson, Julian Falk, freshman in Amherst. Doremus had scolded that he couldn't go to any blame picnic. It was his job as editor to stay home and listen to Bishop Prang's broadcast at 2. But they had laughed at him and rumpled his hair and miscalled him until he had promised. They didn't know it, but he had slyly borrowed a portable radio from his friend, the local R.C. priest, Father Stephen Perifix, and he was going to hear Prang whether or no. He was glad they were going to have Lorinda Pike. He was fond of that sardonic saint. And Buck Titus, who was perhaps his closest intimate. James Buck Titus, who was 50 but looked 38, straight, broad-shouldered, slim-waisted, long-mustached, swarthy. Buck was the Dan'l Boone type of old American, or perhaps an Indian fighting cavalry captain out of Charles King. He had graduated from Williams with 10 weeks in England and 10 years in Montana, divided between cattle raising, prospecting, and a horse breeding ranch. His father, a richish railroad contractor, had left him the great farm near West Beulah, and Buck had come back home to grow apples, to breed Morgan stallions, and to read Voltaire, Anatole France, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky. He served in the war as a private, detested his officers, refused a commission, and liked the Germans at Cologne. He was a useful polo player, but regarded riding to the hounds as childish. In politics, he did not so much yearn over the wrongs of labor as feel scornful of the tight-fisted exploiters who denned in office and stinking factory. He was as near to the English country squire as one may find in America. He was a bachelor with a big mid-Victorian house, well kept by a friendly Negro couple, a tidy place in which he sometimes entertained ladies who were not quite so tidy. He called himself an agnostic instead of an atheist, only because he detested the street-bawling, tract-peddling evangelicism of the professional atheists. He was cynical, he rarely smiled, and he was unwaveringly loyal to all the Jessups. His coming to the picnic made Doremus as blithe as his grandson David. Perhaps, even under fascism, the church clock will stand at 10 to 3 and there will be honey still for tea, Doremus hoped, as he put on his rather dandified country tweeds. The only stain on the preparations for the picnic was the grouchiness of the hired man, Shad Ledoux. When he was asked to turn the ice cream freezer, he growled, "Why the heck don't you folks get an electric freezer?" He grumbled most audibly at the weight of the picnic baskets, and when he was asked to clean up the basement during their absence, he retorted only with a glare of silent fury. "You ought to get rid of that fellow Ledoux," urged Doremus's son Philip, the lawyer. "Oh, I don't know," considered Doremus. "Probably just shiftlessness on my part. But I tell myself I'm doing a social experiment, trying to train him to be as gracious as the average Neanderthal man. Or perhaps I'm scared of him. He's the kind of vindictive peasant that sets fire to barns. Did you know that he actually reads, Phil?" "No." "Yep. Mostly movie magazines with naked ladies and wild western stories, but he also reads the papers. Told me he greatly admired Buzz Windrip. Says Windrip will certainly be president, and then everybody, by which I'm afraid Shad means only himself, will have $5,000 a year. Buzz certainly has a bunch of philanthropists for followers." "Now listen, Dad, you don't understand Senator Windrip. Oh, he's something of a demagogue. He shoots off his mouth a lot about how he'll jack up the income tax and grab the banks. But he won't. That's just molasses for the cockroaches. What he will do, and maybe only he can do it, is to protect us from the murdering, thieving, lying Bolsheviks that would, why, they'd like to stick all of us that are going on this picnic, all the decent, clean people that are accustomed to privacy, into hall bedrooms and make us cook our cabbage soup on a primus stuck on a bed. Yes, or maybe liquidate us entirely. No, sir, Berzelius Windrip is the fellow to balk the dirty, sneaking Jew spies that pose as American liberals." "The face is the face of my reasonably competent son, Philip, but the voice is the voice of the Jew-baiter, Julius Streicher," sighed Doremus. The picnic ground was among a Stonehenge of gray and lichen-painted rocks, fronting a birch grove high up on Mount Terror, on the upland farm of Doremus's cousin, Henry Veder, a solid, reticent Vermonter of the old days. They looked through a distant mountain gap to the faint mercury of Lake Champlain, and across it the bulwark of the Adirondacks. Davy Greenhill and his hero, Buck Titus, wrestled in the hardy pasture grass. Philip and Dr. Fowler Greenhill, Doremus's son-in-law, Phil, plump and half-bald at 32, Fowler, belligerently red-headed and red-mustached, argued about the merits of the autogyro. Doremus lay with his head against a rock, his cap over his eyes, gazing down into the paradise of Beulah Valley. He could not have sworn to it, but he rather thought he saw an angel floating in the radiant upper air above the valley. The women, Emma and Mary Greenhill, Sissy and Philip's wife and Lorinda Pike, were setting out the picnic lunch, a pot of beans with crisp salt pork, fried chicken, potatoes warmed over with croutons, tea biscuits, crabapple jelly, salad, raisin pie, on a red and white tablecloth, spread on a flat rock. But for the parked motor cars, the scene might have been New England in 1885, and you could see the women in chip hats and tight bodiced high-necked frocks with bustles, the men in straw boaters with dangling ribbons and adorned with side whiskers, Doremus's beard not clipped but flowing like a bridal veil. When Dr. Greenhill fetched down Cousin Henry Veder, a bulky yet shy enough pre-Ford farmer in clean faded overalls, then was time again unbought, secure, serene. And the conversation had a comfortable triviality, an affectionate Victorian dullness. However Doremus might fret about conditions, however skittishly Sissy might long for the presence of her beaux, Julian Falk and Malcolm Tasbro, there was nothing modern and neurotic, nothing savoring of Freud, Adler, Marx, Bertrand Russell, or any other divinity of the 1930s, when Mother Emma chattered to Mary and Marilla about her rose bushes that had winter-killed, and the new young maples that the field mice had gnawed, and the difficulty of getting Shad Ladue to bring in enough fireplace wood, and how Shad gorged pork chops and fried potatoes and pie at lunch, which he ate at the Jessup's. And the view. The women talked about the view as honeymooners once talked at Niagara Falls. David and Buck Titus were playing ship now on a rearing rock. It was the bridge, and David was Captain Popeye, and Buck his bosun, and even Dr. Greenhill, that impetuous crusader who was constantly infuriating the County Board of Health by reporting the slovenly state of the poor farm and the stench in the county jail, was lazy in the sun, and with the greatest of concentration kept an unfortunate little ant running back and forth on a twig. His wife Mary, the golfer, the runner-up in state tennis tournaments, the giver of smart but not too bibulous cocktail parties at the country club, the wearer of smart brown tweeds with a green scarf, seemed to have dropped gracefully back into the domesticity of her mother, and to consider as a very weighty thing a recipe for celery and roquefort sandwiches on toasted soda crackers. She was the handsome older Jessup girl again, back in the white house with the mansard roof. And foolish, lying on his back with his forepaws idiotically flopping, was the most pastorally old-fashioned of them all. The only serious flare of conversation was when Buck Titus snarled to Doremus, "Certainly a lot of messiahs pot-natcher from the bushes these days. Buzz Windrip and Bishop Prang and Father Coughlin and Dr. Townsend, though he seems to have gone back to Nazareth, and Upton Sinclair and Reverend Frank Buckman and Bernard McFadden and Willem Randolph Hearst and Governor Talmadge and Floyd Olson and, say, I swear the best messiah in the whole show is this darky, Father Divine. He doesn't just promise he's going to feed the underprivileged 10 years from now. He hands out the fried drumsticks and gizzard right along with the salvation. How about him for president?" Out of nowhere appeared Julian Falk. This young man, freshman in Amherst the past year, grandson of the Episcopal rector and living with the old man because his parents were dead, was in the eyes of Doremus the most nearly tolerable of Sissy's suitors. He was Swede blonde and wiry, with a neat small face and canny eyes. He called Doremus Sir, and he had, unlike most of the radio and motor-hypnotized 18-year-olds in the fort, read a book, and voluntarily. Read Thomas Wolfe and William Rollins, John Strachey and Stuart Chase and Ortega. Whether Sissy preferred him to Malcolm Tasbro, her father did not know. Malcolm was taller and thicker than Julian, and he drove his own streamlined DeSoto, while Julian could only borrow his grandfather's shocking old flivver. Sissy and Julian bickered amiably about Alice Islet's skill in backgammon, and Foolish scratched himself in the sun. But Doremus was not being pastoral. He was being anxious and scientific. While the others jeered, "When does Dad take his audition, and what's he learning to be, a crooner or a hockey announcer?" Doremus was adjusting the doubtful portable radio. Once he thought he was going to be with them in the home sweet home atmosphere, for he tuned in on a program of old songs, and all of them, including Cousin Henry Veder, who had a hidden passion for fiddlers and barn dances and parlor organs, hummed gaily The Troubadour and Maid of Athens and Darling Nellie Gray. But when the announcer informed them that these ditties were being sponsored by Toily Oily, the natural home cathartic, and that they were being rendered by a sextet of young males horribly called the Smoothies, Doremus abruptly shut them off. "Why, what's the matter, Dad?" cried Sissy. "Smoothies! God! This country deserves what it's going to get," snapped Doremus. "Maybe we need a Buzz Windrip." The moment, then, it should have been announced by cathedral chimes, of the weekly address of Bishop Paul Peter Prang. Coming from an airless closet, smelling of sacerdotal woolen union suits in Persepolis, Indiana, it leapt to the farthest stars. It circled the world at 186,000 miles a second, 1,000,000 miles while you stopped to scratch. It crashed into the cabin of a whaler on a dark polar sea. into an office paneled with linen fold oak looted from a Nottinghamshire castle on the 67th story of a building on Wall Street, into the Foreign Office in Tokyo, into the rocky hollow below the shining birches upon Mount Terror in Vermont. Bishop Prang spoke, as he usually did, with a grave kindliness, a virile resonance, which made his self, magically coming to them on the unseen aerial pathway, at once dominating and touched with charm. And whatever his purposes might be, his words were on the side of the angels. "My friends of the radio audience, I shall have but 6 more weekly petitions to make you before the national conventions, which will decide the fate of this distraught nation, and the time has come now to act. To act. Enough of words. Let me put together certain separated phrases out of the 6th chapter of Jeremiah, which seem to have been prophetically written for this hour of desperate crisis in America. O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves together to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem. Prepare ye war. Arise, and let us go up at noon. Woe unto us, for the day goeth away, for the shadows of the evening are stretched out. Arise, and let us go by night, and let us destroy her palaces. I am full of the fury of the Lord. I am weary with holding it in. I will pour it out upon the children abroad, and upon the assembly of young men together. For even the husband with the wife shall be taken, the aged with him that is full of days. I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of this land, saith the Lord. For from the least of them even unto the greatest, every one is given to covetousness. And from the prophet even unto the priest, every one dealeth falsely, saying, Peace, peace, when there is no peace. So spake the book of old, but it was spoken also to America of 1936. There is no peace. For more than a year now, the League of Forgotten Men has warned the politicians, the whole government, that we are sick unto death of being the dispossessed, and that, at last, we are more than 50 million strong, no whimpering horde, but with the will, the voices, the votes to enforce our sovereignty. We have in no uncertain way informed every politician that we demand certain measures, and that we will brook no delay. Again and again we have demanded that both the control of credit and the power to issue money be unqualifiedly taken away from the private banks, that the soldiers not only receive the bonus they, with their blood and anguish, so richly earned in 17 and 18, but that the amount agreed upon be now doubled, that all swollen incomes be severely limited and inheritances cut to such small sums as may support the heirs only in youth and in old age, that labor and farmers' unions be not merely recognized as instruments for joint bargaining, but be made, like the syndicates in Italy, official parts of the government, representing the toilers, and that international Jewish finance, and equally international Jewish communism and anarchism and atheism be, with all the stern solemnity and rigid inflexibility this great nation can show, barred from all activity. Those of you who have listened to me before will understand that I, or rather that the League of Forgotten Men, has no quarrel with individual Jews, that we are proud to have rabbis among our directors. But those subversive international organizations, which unfortunately are so largely Jewish, must be driven with whips and scorpions from off the face of the earth. These demands we have made, and how long now, O Lord, how long have the politicians and the smirking representatives of big business pretended to listen, to obey? Yes, yes, my masters of the League of Forgotten Men, yes, we understand. Just give us time. There is no more time. Their time is over and all their unholy power. The conservative senators, the United States Chamber of Commerce, the giant bankers, the monarchs of steel and motors and electricity and coal, the brokers and the holding companies. They are all of them like the Bourbon kings, of whom it was said that they forgot nothing and they learned nothing. But they died upon the guillotine. Perhaps we can be more merciful to our Bourbons. Perhaps we can save them from the guillotine, the gallows, the swift firing squad. Perhaps we shall, in our new regime, under our new constitution, with our new deal that really will be a new deal and not an arrogant experiment. Perhaps we shall merely make these big bugs of finance and politics sit on hard chairs in dingy offices, toiling unending hours with pen and typewriter as so many white-collar slaves for so many years have toiled for them. It is, as Senator Berzelius Windrip puts it, the zero hour. Now, this second, we have stopped bombarding the heedless ears of these false masters. We're going over the top. At last, after months and months of taking counsel together, the directors of the League of Forgotten Men and I myself announce that in the coming Democratic National Convention, we shall, without one smallest reservation... Listen! Listen! History being made! Doremus cried at his heedless family. Use the tremendous strength of the millions of League members to secure the Democratic presidential nomination for Senator Berzelius Windrip, which means flatly that he will be elected, and that we of the League shall elect him as President of these United States. His program and that of the League do not in all details agree, but he has implicitly pledged himself to take our advice, and at least until election, we shall back him absolutely, with our money, with our loyalty, with our votes, with our prayers. And may the Lord guide him and us across the desert of iniquitous politics and swinishly grasping finance into the golden glory of the promised land. God bless you. Mrs. Jessup said cheerily, "Why, Dormouse, that bishop isn't a fascist at all. He's a regular red radical. But does this announcement of his mean anything, really?" Oh, well, Doremus reflected, he had lived with Emma for 34 years, and not oftener than once or twice a year had he wanted to murder her. Blandly, he said, "Why, nothing much, except that in a couple of years now, on the ground of protecting us, the Buzz Windrip dictatorship will be regimenting everything, from where we may pray to what detective stories we may read." "Sure he will. Sometimes I'm tempted to turn communist. Funny, me with my fat-headed old Hudson River Valley Dutch ancestors," marveled Julian Falk. "Fine idea. Out of the frying pan of Windrip and Hitler into the fire of the New York Daily Worker and Stalin and automatics. And the 5-year plan, I suppose they'd tell me that it's been decided by the commissar that each of my mares is to bear 6 colts a year now," snorted Buck Titus, while Dr. Fowler Greenhill jeered, "Ah, shoot, Dad. And you too, Julian, you young paranoiac. You're monomaniacs. Dictatorship? Better come into the office and let me examine your heads. Why, America's the only free nation on earth. Besides, country's too big for a revolution. No, no, couldn't happen here." Chapter 6